So my question for you is, do you think people are motivated more strongly by negative emotions like fear or by positive emotions like hope?
Well, that is the question that remains to be seen in November.
Welcome to What in God's Name. She is S1 Project co-founder Shayna Appel.
And he is S1 Project founder Chris Owen. It is great to be with you today.
Great to be with you, Shayna. Our mission here at the S1 Project is to foreground moral and theological reflection in conversations about our shared common life.
Oh, I like that. To foreground.
Foreground.
That's nice. I've never heard that as a verb before. But yes, what we are seeking to do is pull to the foreground the elements of morality and ethics in order to get us past the binaries of politics and economics, which dominate so much of the conversation in our public square, but which do little to get us to a place of human flourishing. And given the state we're in, which I think, Chris, is six train stops past crazy land, some public, you know, some conversation in the public square about morality and ethics might be just what's needed right now.
How many stations passed?
At least six. At least six, Chris.
Woe to us if we got, you know, say to a dozen or more.
Yeah, woe to those of us who are still on the train.
Good.
Hello.
We have a spinny wheel. It's a way to warm up our show. A spinny wheel that is like, think Wheel of Fortune. Our spinny wheel is a think, lot smaller.
Think
than...
Wheel of Fortune and then dismiss that thought entirely.
Well, there is a connection. I mean, Wheel of Fortune has a spinny wheel, does it
yes,
not?
It yes, it does. It does. And so do we. However, ours is a unique thing born out of the wisdom of the Swamp Yankees in Great New England. It is a bicycle wheel mounted on a board with a sprinkler head. We give it a spin. It lands on one of the topics that we hold as core ideals here at the S1 Project. We do a little riff on it as a way to loosen up. Chris, I think it's your turn today to give it a spin.
The spinning wheel has landed on robust humility. The robust part is coming to public conversations with conviction. We want, not just us in the S1 Project, but we want to promote this idea that when we, as self-governing citizens, come into conversations about questions regarding our shared common life, come with all of your conviction. Come robustly. Even if you are a religious person, come with your religious convictions. This is not an uncontroversial stance. Our stance is that if you have a religious conviction, that that ought to be allowed, permitted, encouraged in public conversations. There are caveats to go with that, of course, but let's just hold with that idea for a moment. So that's the robust part, which we often don't do. The lenses of politics and economics can tend to shut down. We start reducing public conversations to talking points rather than genuine sharing and genuine conversation, which is all, of course, very difficult to do, but necessary in a democracy. Humility is then this, they're held in tension because we come with conviction and yet also with the stance of wanting to learn from different perspectives, people who have different points of view. So it's not just this, I'm going to beat down the opponent, which is pretty much the model of public conversations, but rather an openness to learning, which humility, you need humility to do that because it's a recognition that, hey, I don't have all the answers. So it's a high standard. This is a high, like this level of conversation to engage that way is a tricky thing, but that's what we're here to promote at the S1 Project.
Yeah, I like that. I like that, the idea of the both and I think in religious terminology, we talk about walking through the world with a holy curiosity. So when we recognize that we are not the be-all and end-all, I have convictions, and I know where I stand on an issue, but I don't stand alone as an island, and no one is free alone. We need groups of people working together in order to live into that realm of freedom together. So I have to know where my neighbors are at. Of course, the challenge in today's world is finding people who you can engage with in conversation who are at least remotely grounded in reality. So that has made this whole project a lot more difficult, but there you have it. There is the tone telling our listeners that we are moving from the topic of the spinny wheel to our topic for today, which is, Chris?
This fall, we are focusing on the presidential election, and a subtitle for our focus on the presidential election is, we are turning Shana loose this fall to talk about politics. And as we talk about the presidential election, as is our mission at the S1 Project, we look for opportunities to ask the kind of question that takes the conversation deeper, a moral question, an ethical question, a theological question. So listen for that. We are going to start today talking about the Electoral College and where it stands and what are some of the issues involved as we move towards this presidential election. And we'll be looking for an opportunity to ask the ethical question or some kind of philosophical question. We don't know yet what that's going to be. So here we go. Shana.
Christopher.
You know, you're the one who's known as the political animal around here. But I do confess that I've been spending some time on a website that I do recommend to our listening community. It's called 270 to Win. It's the number 270 and then 2, T-O-W-I-N, Win. And it's an interactive electoral college map. So basically, you get a map of the United States. All the states are delineated there within with the number of electoral college votes that each state gets. And you can go in and tap the states and play out different scenarios. If Harris wins this state, how many votes does she get? How does that tally up towards the magic number of 270? 270 is the magic number of having the majority of electoral votes and thereby winning the presidential election. Of course, it's important to remember that the popular vote in terms of who wins, doesn't matter. We remember that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote in 2016 by 4 million, wasn't it? I think it was something around 4 million more votes than Trump got in 2016. But she got trounced in the Electoral College because she lost some key states by very narrow margins. So anyway, that's a little excursion. So the Electoral College map. Have you played with the Electoral College map at all, or shall I tell you
I haven't been playing with the Electoral College map largely because it gives me agita. But go ahead and.
So, you know, the battleground states are the most important, and those are Arizona, Nevada, out west. And then
Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania
up there. Yep. And then down south, Georgia and North Carolina now has been called a toss-up by the Cook Political Report. So those are the key Electoral College states. And if you play around with the map, Pennsylvania really ends up being a very
Pennsylvania has just recently emerged as a really key state.
Yeah. So, and it becomes a key state if you assume that Kamala will lose North Carolina and Georgia. If Kamala loses North Carolina and Georgia,
but wins Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Even if she loses Arizona.
Yeah. Yeah. So Pennsylvania becomes key. Basically, it becomes difficult for either candidate if they lose Pennsylvania. So what are your thoughts about numbers and the election and how you see it and how you think about it? I'm just curious. You as the political,
Animal,
that you
yes.
are.
Well, I despise the Electoral College. Its history is rooted in slavery and the fact that while the South had higher population, it had decided that three quarters of its population, its people only were three quarters of a human being, and so they needed to weigh the vote in their favor. So I mean I despise the Electoral College. The bottom line is that the will of the people is not represented in the Electoral College. It is just fundamentally wrong to have 50 people in Montana decide who the next president of the United States is going to be, because the population of Montana is small and so therefore given, you know, more electoral votes. But the system that we have right now under the Electoral College, I'm just fundamentally and morally opposed to. I know, for example, I know Republicans who live out on Cape Cod who, you know, why should they bother to vote? Cape Cod votes Democratic every year, so their vote doesn't matter. So they don't even show up to the polls.
Yeah, for sure. And so you would be in favor of reform that does away with the Electoral College?
I would indeed. How about you?
I haven't really thought about it because
you've been too busy playing with the map.
The reform that I think would really help is ranked choice voting.
Ranked choice voting.
To me, that's more of a priority than reforming the Electoral College, because ranked choice voting would help our primaries be less about appealing to the extremes.
So, I mean, yeah, I support ranked choice voting. I support anything that lifts up the actual popular vote, because I think the system we have in place now is an abomination unto democracy.
Yeah,
really.
So this is it raises a philosophical point. If you think of American history as a progression towards more and more democracy. You mentioned, of course, slavery, and those people did not count as full people. Of course, women
didn't get the vote.
Women didn't get the vote until
the 20th century. First quarter of the 20th century.
Even at the beginning, it was white men with property,
right,
who could vote. So one could tell a story of American history as a progression towards democracy,
towards
democracy, greater and greater democracy. So you might see reform of the Electoral College as another step towards that. And it sounds like you think that anything that promotes more and more democracy is a good thing. Is that true?
Well, democracy is a big word.
I know.
I'm going to be specific and say I think anything that promotes people's participation in the process is a good thing.
Yeah. Okay.
And we have so many people right now who feel so disenfranchised for so many different reasons. And you cannot, we've talked about this in shows in the past, a democracy requires an educated and engaged populace. So with so many people feeling disenfranchised, that is really the bigger threat to democracy than Donald Trump will ever be. Because I think if we had the vast majority of people re-engaged, and we're starting to see the power of that when Harris came into the race, suddenly, you know, there was this boom of voter registrations and young people started to show up, and young people being a constituency that have historically, you know, not engaged in recent history anyway, have not engaged fully in the process. So we've started to see the power of that swing when a personality like Taylor Swift says, get out and register. Suddenly, you know, tens of thousands of people are registering to vote. So seeing that engagement, I think engagement of the populace in the process is the litmus test of the health of democracy.
Engagement of people in the process. So I mean, if you would rank the factors that inhibit or depress people's engagement in the process, I mean, I would not put the Electoral College very high on that list. I would put things like, I would put probably the economy towards the top of that list, like people not feeling part of a shared, disconnected
left behind.
From shared prosperity, being left behind. And so,
except that's the base of the, that right now is the base, that is the MAGA base.
Right.
And I would also add,
and feeling to be the recipients of contempt from the elites. I mean, that's the story that's put.
But all of that has driven up their participation. That is exactly the stuff that Donald Trump is playing on, and it is working with that segment of the population.
That is true.
And that segment of the population has made engagement in politics so ugly that I think it sends other people away who just say, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to be engaged in it.
Yep.
Hopefully on election day, they'll show up to vote. But I know any number of people who I love dearly, who just refuse to engage in politics at all because it's just hateful and they just don't want to get in that water. And that is a problem.
That is a real problem. That is a real problem. So it's hard to see where that one ends happily.
because
part
Chris's
of
Chris's theological tidbit for the day. Yeah, that one doesn't have a happy ending. Depending on why they've disengaged, because I've identified really two groups. A group that is disengaged because, as you put it, they've been left out of the American dream, the economic goal. They feel that there are two Americas. For some reason, they've hitched their wagon to the horses of a multi-millionaire who's been a multi-millionaire and not too many times to count, who knows nothing of their lives or how they're lived, who are now, because of the fear associated with economic deprivation and what that can mean for you in this society, and the consequences are dire. I don't underestimate that, but that fear is being manipulated so that they have accepted an alternative world of facts. So there's that group of people who have disengaged, and now they've used the fear of what can happen when one is economically deprived in this culture to lure those people to an alternative universe, okay? But then there's another group of people who have disengaged because of the ugliness of politics.
Right.
And what has re-engaged them is the message of hope and promise that Harris and Walz have brought. So I guess the results will be known in November. At least the popular vote will be known. Whether or not that takes the day or not depends on how the Electoral College vote shapes out. I want to believe, I really, really, really want to believe that people are sick and tired of the hate and the chaos, and that the vast majority of Americans will turn to a message of hope and promise and lean deeply into the aspirations of this country.
Okay, I have a philosophical question for you. So this is a human nature question. Just my parenthetical commentary. A lot of political questions come down to what kind of view you hold of human nature.
Absolutely.
So my question for you is, do you think people are motivated more strongly by negative emotions like fear or by positive emotions like hope?
Well, that is the question that remains to be seen in November.
I think so. And yeah, I mean, you kind of parse that out a little bit in your political
analysis. Let me say this about the question, and I really want to hear your answer to your own question, because it's a fascinating question. I think there is a continuum, which is to say, I think initially people can be motivated by fear in really powerful ways, but I'm not sure that fear is sustainable. And I think after a while, people just get tired in the same way that people, you know, even many people who voted for Trump the first time are just, they're tired of it. It's like enough already. and they're coming out and saying that they're going to vote for Harris. You know, people have had enough. They may have been initially gripped by a message that told them they were being threatened with life and limb, but you know, it's 8 years later, and I don't think that those same talking points are holding people's attention in the same way. I am an ordained woman of God. I tend to hold the message of fear in the same place that I hold evil, and I hold the message of hope in the same place that I hold promise and goodness. And because I believe that the arc of the universe always bends towards justice, doesn't mean it doesn't dip from time to time. It'll bend to the right occasionally and go off into crazy land, but it eventually comes back. Historically, that has proven to be true. So yeah, I think fear can be an incredibly powerful motivator for a short period of time. I don't believe it has the power to hold people's hearts, hopes, and imagination for the long term.
I'm so grateful to
take that.
I'm just grateful for that, to sit here and I feel like I'm in church and I've been lifted up in a good way.
Oh, good. Well, you're the one who asked the question.
I did ask
the question. It was a brilliant question.
I did ask the question, and I'm torn. I just am so torn, which is such a wishy-washy place to be on this question.
It's a realistic place to be because, truthfully, until this damn election is over, we're not going to know where we are as a nation on that continuum.
Yeah.
And what is weighing more heavily on people right now, fear or hope?
Yeah. So I'm going to parse it this way, which I don't necessarily endorse, but I just want to hear myself say it out loud. I mean, part of what I feel inside myself as I consider this question is a difference between the political realm and the theological faith realm. And what I don't like about parsing it that way is that I'm creating a kind of no contact zone between the two that I don't really believe exists.
Is inconsistent with the values of the S1 project. Yes, Chris, we're all aware.
Yeah, yeah.
But continue.
No, thank you. I will. I think politically fear works. It's proven to work at various times.
For short periods of time, it does.
And I appreciate that perspective that you put on it, that fear has a shelf life.
So beautifully said.
Yeah, so I appreciate that perspective. I think there is the deeper abiding power in human beings is hope.
I don't think you need to be religious,
yeah,
particularly either, but I fundamentally believe that we are all created in the divine image.
Yeah.
And the divine image may run for a time. I mean, you know, and longtime listeners know that I do a lot of work with horses. Horses, if you've ever noticed, their eyes are on the side of their head, indicating that they are animals of prey. They are preyed upon. They are not predators. If you spook a horse, it's going to run. It's going to run like crazy. And it's going to run for about a mile. And then it's going to stop and turn around and see if there's anything it still needs to be afraid of.
Yeah.
So fear in even a primal animal like a horse has a shelf life. Mm. Now, what can happen in the process of that horse spooking can be extraordinarily destructive. I mean, God, if that horse is tethered to a carriage, those have been some of the worst wrecks I've ever seen, or a horse who speaks and runs through a jump or tosses its rider. I mean, it can be very explosive and dynamic and frightening, but it has a shelf life. Even a horse will stop after about a mile to see if there's anything behind them. You can say that we're under threat by immigrants who are eating cats in Springfield. You can run with that for a certain amount of time, but it's not true. Before, it may take their folks longer to get out there and see that. But eventually, I mean, eventually, it will be found to be groundless.
Yeah, you've anticipated something that I was going to amplify with regards to this question of hope versus fear, which is, you know, putting myself in the shoes of someone who supports Trump. They would say, that person would say, well, he's the ground of our hope. He's the one who's going to save whatever, save the country. And
God, I know it's true, but it's still...
I know. It's hard to entertain.
This guy can be swayed by a tweet, for the love of God.
Yeah, so, you know, we talked about last time, there's so much emotionality going on, but that's not my point. My point is that if your hope is grounded in something, if you have a false hope, if your hope is grounded in falsehood, that's a false hope, and it proves to be false at some point. I mean, this is this temporality that you've so brilliantly raised for us, that these things based on falsehood cannot endure. Because that's the nature of something that is false. It doesn't endure. And so so that's another distinction to raise. It's like where is the ground of true hope versus a false hope? I also wonder, Shana, about, I mean, this gets to kind of an Augustinian perspective on the kingdoms of this world and the king and God's kingdom, to put it in Christian theological terms. There's always a sense that ultimate hope is not to be found in the kingdoms of this world. I think that's a perspective that also needs to be voiced. I mean, it's a false. There are different layers and textures to the falsehood of hope. And if ultimate hope, like if you put your ultimate hope in any kind of political regime, then you're going to be disappointed, because it's a human endeavor, and therefore subject to the follies and foibles, shortcomings of human beings. That's my Augustinian theological take coming through.
It's a Parker Palmer quote about realizing that everything that is human, made with human hands, is temporary, and that the only thing that is everlasting are the works of God. In non-religious language, we say things like, or it seems to be generally accepted, and maybe I'm overreaching here, that, you know, love is the only thing that is eternal. Everything else perishes. I rest my case. There is nothing about what is happening right now in the Republican Party that speaks of love of anything other than self and Donald Trump. So the message that Harris and Walz are putting out there about hope holds out promise. And because I believe everything does begin with the word, I think when you get a roll going in the same way that happened during Obama's tenure, we do start to see some of the best and the brightest things coming out of our nation, things that we can be really proud of now. But I also have to say, and I will again prophesy, you heard it here first, I think Republicans are going to lose the House, and I think they're going to lose the executive branch, and it remains to be seen whether the Democrats can hold on to the slim majority in the Senate. But if that happens, then I think the next 4 years could be really interesting for us, and could, if the left, if the progressives, the Democrats, those who are, you know, voting for hope and change, do not then sit on their arses and gloat about their victory, but instead turn around and try to make some reparations, that we could potentially bring our whole country forward with us. But there's a lot of work to be done after the election, even if Harris Walz win. Right. And we'll talk about that more after November.
Indeed we will. So let me recap our conversation. I was just going through my head where we've been, and I started with the Electoral College, and that got us into a conversation about participation and feeling enfranchised, which got us into a conversation of those who have turned away out of disgust and what might bring them back. And that's when I asked the question about how
the
human
power
beings are motivated,
fear versus hope.
And I think this, so, you know.
Imagine that. We started with the political.
And found,
and found our way back.
The theological. We found the theological. We did. And so it reminds me, and maybe this is a place to stop, although you might have a rejoinder, but it reminds me of at least how I think of politics, which is rightly understood. Rightly understood, politics is about, it's certainly about how we shall live together, which is the way that you have spoken it in the past. But it is also about hope and a future and what that might look like. And that ends up being a theological question. What is in store? Where are we heading? And what is the ground of our hope? So, you know, politics and theology are, they've always been in historically connected with those kinds of questions. Be curious, Shana.
Go deep, Chris.
And shine light.
Thank you, listeners, for tuning in to another episode of What in God's Name. We are here by the grace and generosity of our generous donors on Patreon. If you would like to become one of those generous donors, go to patreon.org.
You can check us out online at our website, s1project.org. That's s1project.org. Shana, great to be with you today.
Always great to be with you, Chris.